It's time now for our annual budget campaign moment, and Fran Pardee has a few words to share with us.
Good morning, everyone. I joined this church over 30 years ago when my children were very young. Although I was raised in the United Church, I fell away from it in my teens, so I had never before been an adult member of a church. When the budget campaign rolled around in my first year, I wasn't at all clear about what was going on. I'd never even heard the word pledge as it was being used in the context of the campaign. All it conjured up for me was allegiance to the Queen. I came to understand that each member of the church was being asked to make a commitment, albeit a non-legally binding one, indicating what their financial contribution would be in the coming year so that the church could plan its budget. Over the next several years, as we faced all the myriad of expenses that families raising young children face, my financial contribution to the church was modest, and I did my best to contribute volunteer energy as well. And I'll tell you a little story about these days. My daughter was about 13 years old and was becoming keen about fashion and shopping and the right brand of clothes and all that sort of thing. And during the budget campaign, she asked me, "Do you have to give money to the church?" And I explained, she was really emphasizing this "have to," that I didn't have to, but that I wanted to because the church was important to me. And it needed money to exist, to pay for the heat and the electricity and the minister's salary and all the books and RE and all that sort of thing. I could see that she was really struggling with this idea of not having to give money, but choosing to do so anyway. And then she asked, "How much money do you give to the church?" And when I said, "Now, mind you, this is 20 years ago," I said, $400. She was incredulous. Visions of so many pairs of name brand jeans and t-shirts and all the bits and baubles that she desired danced in her head. And if I didn't give it to the church, I could spend it on her. So fast forward to today, and I can assure you that my daughter fully appreciates all that I receive from this church community and no longer puzzles over my financial contribution to sustain it as best I can. When I'm determining how much I can give, I often think about what I would have to pay if I sang in a community choir or attended a privately run workshop like our Soul Matters program, or musical events like jazz vespers at a commercial venue. There would be costs associated with all those activities. So a small part of my thinking around my pledge is to put a monetary value on the opportunities that the church provides for me. But then there are the values of spiritual sustenance, beloved community, and sustainability. Much harder to quantify, but far more significant in components in determining my pledge. When friends ask me where the church gets its money, I often say, "Well, there's no Rome for Unitarians." What we experience here, our buildings, the grounds, the programs, the ministry, is due to the generosity of members of this congregation who came before, and the generosity of those who are here now. I feel so fortunate to benefit from all that has been generously given in the past, and I'm so grateful that the church was here for me when I went looking for a spiritual home. I will happily contribute what I can so that this church survives and thrives into the future. It supports and challenges me in my quest to be the best Fran I can be. And it has held me in love during the good times and the bad. In a spirit of gratitude and generosity, I will increase my pledge this year so that the objectives of the budget campaign, a focus on improving the overall compensation and situation for our staff, might be met. Thank you.
United World Colleges, of which Pearson College in Metchosin is a part, has as their motto to make education a force to unite people, nations, and cultures for peace and a sustainable future. I can't think of much that aligns better with our values than that. I'd like to introduce Juliana and Agnes, who will tell you more.
Hello, my name is Agnes. I'm from Cameroon. First of all, thank you guys for welcoming us into your community. It's the first time for me to come to Unitarian Church. About Pearson College. Pearson College is a school with more than 200 students in it and more than 200 cultures. As Andy earlier said, it's a school, like, it's a movement to unite people from different places, diversity, and no matter their race, like, we learn at Pearson how to respect each other, no matter his race and wherever he comes from. And it's a movement that we really enjoy. Like, everybody is kind, welcome, and the place is really nice. How can I say? In fact, I don't know what to say much about Pearson, but just, like, it's a nice school, nice, like, because for me, I've never gone out of my country. It's my first time, and Pearson College really helps me, because when I first came, I was really shy. I was like, oh my God, I'm far from home. I'm far from home. I was really homesick for the first time, but everybody there is really nice. They helped me to find a home. They're like, really, like, they act like your family, so Pearson College is really nice.
Hello, my name is Juliana, and I'm from Russia. Thank you. Yeah, my name is Juliana. I'm from Russia, St. Petersburg, and this is my first year in Pearson College too, the first month. This was the one of the most exciting and active months of my life so far, because when I first came to Pearson College, when I just first knew I'm nominated for a place in Pearson College, I just read every piece of information I could find about the college. And I thought, I have a kind of idea about what's my life going to be like in Pearson. But really, I wasn't even close to it. Because I still thought about Pearson as a school, as a place where you come to study, like, get your diploma, spend your high school years, like, whatever. But actually, the Pearson is so much more than just school, than just studying. Of course, academics are really good, like, is really good part of it. IB program is good program for studying, but it's actually the smaller part of the Pearson experience. Because lots of these activities, conversations, which are around you during all your life on campus and around the campus, which are just, they're different from academics. And, yeah. I'm sorry. Sorry, I wasn't. Probably the one of the greatest things there is that people from absolutely different places. For example, I live in a room with the girls from Mongolia and from Belize, and we live in one room, and we actually kind of have something in common, we all. And this is one of the most wonderful parts of the Pearson College. All of us are the first time so far from their homes, and actually the English is not the first language for many people. Most of the people don't come home like more than a year because they stay here like in host families or on campus. So for many people, it's some kind of the, it's a long experience. It's they for a long time far from home. So all these ideas and values from Pearson College are, it's kind of their everyday life, and they just live inside of it. And it kind of, it feels students. So it's some kind of the, it's something which stays with them like long after they finish the Pearson College. Even when these 2 years have passed, it never goes away. It always stays with them. So I think it's going to be like the lifelong experience. And yeah, I'm really happy to think that I have 2 more years.
Let's go to church, my 17-year-old daughter said to me one day, she who had never been to a church any day in her life. What brought this on, I asked. I should join a youth group, she responded. We had been struggling with her mental health issues for several years, and I was always trying to find a lifeline to throw for her, from volunteer opportunities to equine therapy, something, anything to help her out. This sounded like a potential lifeline. So I ran to my computer and Googled Victoria Youth Groups. And up popped the First Unitarian Church of Victoria. And hey, it's just down the road from where I live. I checked out the 7 principles. The inherent worth and dignity of every person. Well, yeah. Justice, equity, and compassion. Of course. Acceptance and encouragement to spiritual growth. Agreed. A free and responsible search for truth and meaning. Oh, interesting. Yeah. The right of conscience and the use of the democratic process. Well, yeah, totally. World community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. A no-brainer. Respect for the interdependent web of all existence. Absolutely. With growing anticipation, I perused the website. Small groups from Buddhists to atheists, neighborhood groups, refugee sponsorship, social and environmental actions, all things I valued or was interested in. I don't know about my daughter, I thought, but this is something that I could get into. A couple of weeks later, I attended my first service and came away feeling lighter, uplifted. Now, 2 years later, I've made new friends, become rather involved in church activities, and I have grown in both spirit and in mind. I am learning that open-mindedness is not a state of mind, but an opening or a door to a mind. A door that I'm discovering is only partially open. It is taking some considerable effort and perhaps a little pain to open it wider and wider still. I must admit I do still cringe with the use of the words church and religion, which for me carry a lot of baggage, and they don't really encapsulate how I view this community and the UU values as I see them. But maybe I just need to open that door a little wider someday, perhaps. I now feel that I belong to this community, and this community belongs to me. I'm grateful for Unitarian Universalism. I am grateful to all of you who have become my friends. But most of all, I am grateful to my daughter, because even though it didn't work out for her, And even though it might have been inadvertent on her part, it turns out that my daughter was the one who threw me a lifeline by throwing down the challenge. Let's go to church.
I should note that if you enjoyed that last song, that last anthem, Brian Tate, the writer of that anthem, and many other pieces that we all enjoy, will be here with us in 2 weeks. He's going to be probably playing the piano and conducting our choir and a bunch of other folks in for our Pledge Sunday, so I hope you'll be here October 20th. I'm kind of eager to meet him because I've heard his music for at least a decade now. I'm curious what he's actually like as a person, so we can all find out together in a couple of weeks. Well, this morning's sermon is entitled, We Belong to a History, and there are two brief readings that go with it. The first is from one of our four fathers on the Unitarian side of our family tree, the one who gets quoted a lot. His name is William Ellery Channing, and those of you who have been to Boston will know that there is a large statue of William Ellery Channing on the edge of the Boston Common facing Arlington Street Church, one of the first major Unitarian sort of cathedrals. And I've often thought if you were the minister there, it would be quite intimidating because when the front doors are open, Channing is looking kind of right in to the pulpit. So Kim Crawford Harvey, who is our colleague there, must have Channing staring her in the face all the time. And sometimes folks like to joke around and walk past his statue and just call him Bill. But William Ellery Channing wrote some amazing sermons, and this was one of his from 1828, a sermon of his entitled Likeness to God, which has been edited slightly for more inclusive, shall we say, 21st century language. Channing wrote, I affirm and would maintain that true religion consists in proposing as our great end a growing likeness to the supreme being. Its noblest influence consists in making us more and more partakers of the divinity. Religious instruction should aim chiefly to turn people's aspirations and efforts to that perfection of the soul, which constitutes it a bright image of God. It is only in proportion to this likeness that we can enjoy either God or the universe. This likeness, he goes on to say, does not consist in extraordinary or miraculous gifts, in supernatural additions to the soul, or in anything foreign to our original constitution, but in our essential faculties unfolded by vigorous and conscientious exertion in the ordinary circumstances assigned by God. To resemble our Creator, we need not fly from society and entrance ourselves in lonely contemplation and prayer. Our proper work is to approach God by the free and natural unfolding of our highest powers of understanding, conscience, love, and the moral will. End quote. Sounds like a mouthful, but I think you kind of get what he's saying there. You don't need anything other than what we already have as human beings as a part of us to become more like what he called divinity, supreme being, God, whatever phrase you want to give to that. The second quotation is from Alice Walker, who wrote a very brief piece. I wouldn't even call it a poem exactly, but she wrote something in the 1980s entitled In These Dissenting Times. And I think, my friends, that we still live in dissenting times. And this is what she wrote. To acknowledge our ancestors means we are aware that we did not make ourselves, that the line stretches all the way back, perhaps to God or to gods. We remember them because it is an easy thing to forget that we are not the first to suffer, rebel, fight, love, and die. The grace with which we embrace life in spite of the pain, the sorrows, is always a measure of what has gone before. We belong to a history. It feels like stating the obvious to say that we contemporary Unitarian Universalists belong to a history that stretches back to our ancestors in this tradition. It may be obvious, but it is not simple. As with most legacies, ours is a complex one, full of compelling and remarkable stories of women and men and likely trans folks, although we know those stories less well, who lived lives of deep integrity and questioning. People who built a faith tradition that questioned what had come before and, however imperfectly, tried to keep forging a path of freedom and meaning. Channing's quotation for me highlights that. What a beautiful image that we are like God and that we have to live toward that, but not so much in miraculous ways, but just in our regular humanness. And yet that's also an image that is incredibly hard to live up to. So allow me now, if you might, for me to summarize 400 years of history in a minute. Beginning with Unitarianism, because I think actually, Melora and I were talking this morning, I don't think we talked to you guys enough about our history. So I think a lot of people are like, yeah, we know we have one, but we don't really know any of these Unitarian Universalist people. And we kind of need to know our history, right? We didn't, as Alice Walker said, we didn't make ourselves, right? We didn't come from nothing. We came from something and someones. So our story on the Unitarian side begins with a man we used to call Michael Servetus, but I think is more appropriately called Miguel Serveto, because he was a Spaniard. And he wrote a book in 1531 entitled On the Errors of the Trinity. And there began Unitarianism in 1531. The main points of his book and of Unitarianism more broadly was the view that God was one, not in three parts as in the Trinity, but Unitarianism as opposed to Trinitarianism, and that the defining characteristic of that God was love. The other half of our history, the Universalist side of our family tree, contended that all are saved. Universalists as in universal salvation, not as in the Calvinist view that some were predestined and predetermined. You already knew, it's still outrageous to me, you already knew at birth who was in and who was out, right? That's what Calvin said. And there were a bunch of people, including Quaker ancestor John Fox, who said, this doesn't make any sense at all. And the Universalists, including a man by the name of Hosea Ballou, who was one of our founding fathers, and John Murray, chief proponents among them, believed that all are born blessed and beloved, not sinful and fallen, and that the purpose of spiritual or religious community is to cultivate our connection to that part of ourselves which is part of that larger love. Whether you call that larger love community, or the holy, or God, or human family, whatever you call it, that larger love is what our Universalist forebears believed we needed to live out of. And so we needed to live, they believed, into our belovedness and out of our belovedness so that we might live in a way that was rooted with our most compassionate and whole selves. All of that is really the fundamental basis of our tradition. I heard one person once describe it, a colleague of ours, as the Unitarians believing that all are one and Universalists believing that all are in. One love, all in, my colleague said. Over the following 400 years or so, other streams of thought and practice have come in and enlivened those two large umbrellas of tradition. In the Unitarian side of our tree, most famously, the Transcendentalist movement of Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller. We often don't talk about the woman, but Margaret Fuller was also really important in that stream of thought. And the care for others and focus on service brought in by people like Clara Barton and, of course, Canadian Lotta Hitchmanova. And, of course, during those 400 years of ferment and torment, there were also lots of controversies and conversations that took place within Unitarianism and Universalism about suffrage and abolition in particular, with the likes of Susan B. Anthony, William Ellery Channing, who I quoted to you before. He wrestled a lot with abolition. He was on one side and then the other. And ministers of color, who we rarely talk about, but who were really important in trying to move Unitarianism forward and often were sort of marginalized. The Unitarian Church often didn't support their ministries, and that's an important part of our story, too. I invite you to look up the story of Louis McGee and Egbert Ethelred Brown, who I told you about briefly before. So in the midst of all of that, after all of these midst of these conversations, began a huge conversation in the 1930s around humanism. Two of the key people in our faith tradition on the Unitarian side were men by the name of John Dietrich and Curtis Rees, huge amongst the people who signed a document called the Humanist Manifesto. And in the midst of all of this conversation about the possibilities and the promise of human community, even more tumult and change came. And while I want to lift up this kind of conversation between the folks who were sort of believers and the humanists in our tradition, I want to lift up something today, because I was just in Edmonton this weekend and I was doing this keynote address and I had this interesting conversation. I was kind of like a guest amongst a whole bunch of United Church people, so it was a lot of fun. And I was saying to them there that we still have this conversation in Unitarian Universalism today about sort of the people among us who see themselves as kind of spiritual theistic folks like myself, and people who see themselves as humanists. We have an AHA group here, you know, the atheist, humanist, agnostic group. And somehow we almost seem like to think like this is a new conversation. And I'm like, no. This is the conversation that we've been having for hundreds of years. And all of those folks have always found a home under this umbrella. And what's most important to me is that we continue to all have a home under the umbrella and not see it as I'm trying to convince you of my belief and you're trying to, no. The most important piece is that we respect one another's beliefs within this larger umbrella of our tradition. And it's part of what I learned from going back to our history. We respect and appreciate that search for truth and meaning that each of us is on. So where does this all lead today? That was my 400 years of history in, you know, a couple minutes. Well, it's led to a lot of good things, an appreciation of science and a questioning of the status quo. It's led to an appreciation of what we could accomplish as a human community in addressing the problems and the challenges of the day, appreciation for medical advances and political alliances and new discoveries and new knowledge. You could also say, however, that it has also led to some unfounded optimism, which haunts us to this day, both as a spiritual community and in some of our larger social dynamics. In fact, I think a lot of folks, when they talk to Unitarian Universalists, they say, well, if you have this great image that God was so great, and you have this great image that human beings are so great, what do you do with evil? What do you do with the bad things that happen in the world? Your tradition was so positive, so optimistic. But surely we see in the stories of lives that it hasn't all been positive or optimistic. So in fact, one of my colleagues I'm going to be talking to you about her book this morning has written a book about just that tension that we still wrestle with today. Our colleague Nancy McDonald Ladd, who serves in Bethesda, Maryland, she's a part of my support group when I lived in the D.C. area, wrote a book entitled After the Good News. Because what happens after the good news, right? That's the real question. And part of what she reminds us is there was a progressive Christian minister in New York City named Henry Emerson Fosdick. He lived from 1878 to 1969. And he wrote about the kind of fissure between modernists and fundamentalists at his time. And he diagnosed what he saw as going on in a very prescient way. Listen to this. Okay, he wrote a sermon entitled Why the Church Must Go Beyond Modernism back in 1935. And here's what he wrote, or this is what Nancy MacDonald Ladd says she summarizes in her book After the Good News. Fosdick died knowing that the next step for all religious liberals was not to return to an orthodox conception of scripture, revelation, or atonement. Instead, he believed we must reclaim our ability to stand in the presence of collective tragedy, systemic oppression, and personal sinfulness without sunnily reframing it into a narrative of illimitable progress. He proclaimed that this could only happen through the application of humility and grace, and that this would bring with it both deep discomfort and abundant change. Wow. I read that sentence and I was like, whoa, whoa. Fosdick could have been writing that to us right now. Our Unitarian ancestors, however, did not really heed Fosdick's warning. In many ways, the next several decades of Unitarian, more so than Universalist, thought and preaching was rooted in what MacDonald Ladd terms as the myth of illimitable progress. Onward and upward, forever in everything. That may seem hopeful, but it can also be daunting. Most of our lives don't move in a direct upward trajectory. It is too much to have to keep up with and to have to project outward when it isn't true that our lives are not moving upward, onward, forever. How many suffer in silence out of shame or worry or a sense of failure because things have not improved in their lives? It is hard to live with a constant sense that things will be more and better all the time. This myth has hurt us in many ways, has hurt all of us in many ways. And as MacDonald Ladd goes on to point out, it has hurt those on the margins even more. And I quote her, "A progressive, forward-leaning history of unremitting generational progress is, by its very nature, a white people's history, a story told by the dominant parties who wished, by means of propaganda and willful ignorance, to perpetuate their dominance into the next generation. If privileged fundamentalists always look back and privileged progressives always look forward, the sins of our forebears and the achievements of our future selves are always beckoning on either side of the present moment. But those on the margins of societal power cannot afford the luxury of ideological time travel. They are trying to live where they are, not place their hope on a distant past, or broadcast it out into a purely theoretical future." End quote. Wowzers. Nancy just told us, laid down some truth there. Part of the power of Nancy MacDonald Ladd's looking at our belonging to a history that upsets the possible and ongoing progress is that it has left out the wholeness of our lives and the truth that many of us have experienced. We need the humility and the grace of which Fosdick spoke, and we need the willingness to confront the deep discomfort so that deep change can be possible. To that end, MacDonald Ladd lifts up the need and the place of belonging that we can create together. And she sees us as needing to create powerful spiritual practices and truths rooted really in three things. The first thing she says we need to do is to let go of perfectionism. We are not going to get things right. And that, she says, is not the point. And I would add to that that I think people on the margins don't really, at least I never really got this whole perfectionism thing, because perfect was never an option to begin with, right? People on the margin are like, perfect? I was enslaved. What are you talking about? Things ain't never going to be perfect, okay? So let's let go of perfectionism. None of us are perfect. We're not going to be perfect. Life is not going to be perfect. Then, two, she says, we need places where we can atone. Wednesday, our Jewish siblings are going to be honoring Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, a day when we need to not just apologize for mistakes that we have made, but commit to being better and doing better whenever and wherever we can. I was visiting with a friend of mine, and his daughter said something that was kind of careless, and he said, I'm sorry. And he said, well, you know, and she's like, I know. Don't just say sorry, do better. But friends, when we atone for something, we don't just say sorry in kind of a flip way. We say sorry in a way that says, gosh, I may have caused some harm there. And I'm going to try to learn from this moment and do better next time. That's when an apology carries real weight to it. And atonement is that level of apology. To atone for a mistake is to really say, I'm sorry, but I'm not going to just say sorry. I'm going to be better. And third, Nancy says, we need places to practice lament. And I think she's right. Lament in that deep kind of, you know, there's a whole book of lamentations, because our forebears used to be really good at weeping together, at the gnashing of teeth and the rending of garments and the crying together. And yet I think in our current culture, we grieve too often on our own. We need a place to go with our collective sense of loss and grief. We need to weep together for what is not and has never been. We need to weep together for harm that has been done in the name of progress. Theologically, this means remembering that we belong to each other. I'll say that again. Theologically, this means remembering that we belong to each other, that we belong to a planet and a mystery that is greater than any one individual life and that is home to us all. It means holding the complexity and the reality of the fact that we will not go onward and upward. Though progress has been made, struggle and failure has always been a part of the equation, and I think will always continue to be a part of the equation. In our service this afternoon, Liz is going to share some about the Anglican Creed, and so I thought it would be good for me to try to write a Unitarian Universalist Creed, which is pretty brave and bold since we're so proud of the fact we don't have a creed. But if I were to write one that I think those forebears of the last 400 years would be able to live with and that would recognize and honor where we are right now, I would say something like this. I believe in the spirit of life, which holds us all. I believe in the wisdom of all the great spiritual teachers throughout time, and that I can still learn from them today. I believe that love and compassion are the greatest tools I have for living in harmony with the earth and all beings. I believe I will make mistakes and need to be forgiven, offering grace and humility in abundance to myself and others. I believe that living with a sense of purpose and meaning is crucial to my ability to feel connected to the web of life. I believe that it is not perfection for which we were made, but to love and to add our unique gifts to the good of the whole. May we embrace the riches of our history, the beauty of the present, and act toward a future that includes and enlivens us all. Blessed be, and amen.